having a little difficulty with that one, as you can see. Maybe you've seen it. Maybe you've got an explanation for it, John. KD2BV, K2RIW.
K2RIW and the TechNet from KD2BD. Yes, I have seen frequency shifts with changing antenna polarization. Not as much as I believe Mel is reporting. In other words, I'm not seeing as much enough that would be audible. I'm seeing a fraction of a hertz difference. And over a period of time, I might see the signals from each antenna to be tracking one another and traveling in the same direction, but be slightly offset from one another. And then occasionally they divert and go in opposite directions for a little while, and then kind of come back a little later. So I have a couple of theories on that. I think some of that has to do with Faraday rotation. I think possibly some of it has to do with the idea that when RF on HF frequencies is sent to the ionosphere, it splits into two different waves. One's called an ordinary wave, one's called an extraordinary wave, and they travel differently and they behave differently in the ionosphere. And one of those two is affected by the magnetic field while the other one isn't. And they both essentially come back down to ground, and they interact with one another. They interact with how your antenna is polarized, and I believe that if you happen to be co-polarized with one of those waves, then you're going to receive the signal on one particular frequency because it's traveled through a slightly different path than a different polarization would provide. So I think some of that is going on. This gentleman, ZL1 Bravo Papa Uniform, ZL1 BPU, has a very nice website where he describes some of this propagation phenomena and has spectrogram plots of distant carriers that he's monitored, and you can see how the signals split in pairs and they recombine over time. It's really quite fascinating. K2REW on the TechNet from KD2BD.
I'm reasonably sure that you told us in the past that you're listening to WWVB at 60 kilohertz because it's a very reliable signal. You set up a loop antenna with a preamplifier. You heard the signal. You were kind of amazed. And then you eventually perfected for yourself a very nice receiver. If I compare that to the reliability at which you listen to 2.5, 5, 10, and 15 megacycles, I am of the belief that even with a real good antenna system, the other HF frequencies have some nasty fades where they go into very deep fades and very weak signal strengths for significant periods of time, and therefore as a frequency reference are pretty tough to use. Whereas if I understand you correctly, the 60 kilohertz signal is there 24/7, 365 days a year, and maybe 25 dB out of the noise most of the time. And so what kind of signal strength, if you plotted decibels above your threshold for the 60 kilohertz signal, and you made a graph of that, what would that graph look like compared to the 2.5, 5, 10, and 15 megacycle graph? Over to you, John, KD2BD, K2RIW.
Hate to say why, one more comment.
Okay. Mel, go ahead.
The only way that you notice the change in this tone is when you run with a very narrow filter. I was running with a filter, about a 250 cycle filter thing. So that's the way I can notice it. You got to run with a fairly narrow filter to really notice it. Otherwise, you wouldn't hear it. It's not that prevalent. It's a slight shift. However, at times on 75-meter phone, at certain times of the year, they said because of the Borealis, the northern light, you hear this change in the sound of the people that, you talk to regularly. You hear all of a sudden, a change in their voice pattern or I don't know really how to describe it, but it creates a different path, over.
And now that I know you were listening to him on 80 meters, 35, I forget what frequency you just told me, 3508, and any shift in frequency becomes a shift in tone, particularly in a narrowband filter. Now I have no doubt you heard him at a different frequency. If you were listening to him on single sideband, and you think that his voice became a little higher and lower in pitch, that's kind of subjective. Properly aligning a receiver for getting the best fidelity of a sideband signal, each guy aligns the receiver a little bit differently. But when listening to Morse code, and if you're a good Morse code operator, the pitch of the tone you're listening to of the Morse code is something that gets burned in your memory, and one or two hertz of shift, you will hear it and be able to recognize and resolve it. So I have no doubt that you heard a different frequency. So John's going to explain that to us. That's a little bit of a joke. But I am curious as to the graph of signal strength of 60 kilohertz versus 2.5, 5, 10, and 15 megacycles. If you made such a graph, what would it look like, and what's your average dB above threshold for the 60 kilohertz signal, John? 82 BV, K2RIW.
K2RIW and the TechNet from KD2BD. Well, there are actually some graphs online regarding WWVB reception. The National Institute of Standards and Technology has placed some receivers in operation around the country, and I think they're probably interested in adding some more. And they continuously pull those receivers for signal strength and noise level measurements. And on one of their websites, they have a map where you could look at a receiver in Maryland, a receiver in Boulder, and some other areas of the United States, and you can see a plot of what the signal strength is now and what the running signal strength has been for however many days you want to look at. And generally what you see is a diurnal effect around sunset and sunrise, where you may get some a dip in the signal strength for maybe as long as a half an hour. And it may not be a very critical dip either. If you're in a fairly quiet area and the noise level isn't very high, it's probably not going to cause you any trouble. But the thing is that you get one dip a day at 60 kilohertz. If you're listening to WWZ on 2.5, 5, or any of the other HF frequencies, you're probably going to get signal dips several times per minute. That's a big difference. I've noticed in doing some of these frequency measurement tests, one thing that I thought was very fascinating was that some of that there are signal fades and then there are signal fades. During last week's frequency measurement test, I copied K5CM on 80 meters, and I noticed the signal faded a couple of times during his key down period, but it was a very shallow and slow fade. And when the signal came up, back up out of the fade, there really wasn't much of a phase shift in the signal when it came back up. There were other times where the signal would drop very quickly into a very sharp dip and then come back up again and become very strong again. But when the signal fades like that, it almost always comes out of that fade with a 180 degree phase shift from what it had been previous to that dip. So I think there's some kind of a multipath or some kind of a third irritation effect going on there. Whereas the slow fades, I don't think are really related to multipath. And another piece of evidence of that is that
repeater timeout.
Fascinating. I've got a handheld receiver that can listen to 2.5, 5, 10, and 15 megacycles for setting my watch. And there are times when I just can't find a signal. Or when I do find a signal, it is fading up and down during different portions of a minute. And of course, it always fades down during the voice announcement as to what time it is. So I have trouble setting my watch. It takes me quite a while. There are so-called atomic watches we can buy, John, where the watch itself resets itself, I guess, at something like 2 o'clock in the morning by listening to the WWV signal, is my guess. Is that what's going on, John? Is that the frequency the watch listens to in order to reset itself? And I guess there's the signal probably has a digital code to it. I'm kind of curious as to how it's modulated, which really tells it what hour, date, and time, and so on, is being transmitted at that time. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
60 kilohertz, Dick, and it's biphase.
So it's biphase modulation, and what is the actual data? The hour, minute, and second, or hour and minute, and it gives you a reset cycle, so to speak, at the top of each individual minute. Does it also identify the day, which I guess is not really required? Over to you for that one, Eric.
Yeah, it's actually transmitted by WWBB. It's got hours, days, minutes, year, and it also has a bit in there for sidereal time. So, but if you go to the NIST website, it'll spell the whole thing out for you.
It's the Leone.
Go ahead, Rich.
Yeah, I just want to say, I was going to say 60 kilohertz. You know, I have four of those clocks in the house. MFJ, of all people, makes them atomic clocks, as they call them. I've got four of them here. This way I don't have to be sensitive of daylight saving time versus Eastern Standard Time. All you have to do is set the difference in hours on Eastern Standard 5 hours from GMT, and it takes into account the daylight savings. It takes into account the minutes, the seconds. So very, very nice. I forget what I paid for them. I think they were $40 or $50 a piece. They've got very large digits, like 3-inch LCD digits. I can see them in the dwarf room. I got them in the living room, the kitchen, the bedroom, and they call them actually their eternal clock, because they run off. They've got battery backup, but they run off of solar cells. Quite nice. Not just for the ham shack, good around the house.
That's real fun. But in the case of a wristwatch, the question I've got for John is that how big is and how many turns are there on the coil that allows you the loop antenna that you're using for 60 kilohertz reception? And think of the miniaturization that goes on inside of the metallic case of a wristwatch. To put a 60 kilohertz coil in there and a low enough receiver preamplifier to get good reception of the 60 kilohertz, that's a darn good trick, isn't it, John? KD2BD, K2RIW.
Mine has a hunk of ferrite in the strap.
How about that? Over to you, John.
K2RIW and the TechNet from KD2BD. Yes, they have an actual 60 kilohertz resin antenna in those clocks. Sometimes it's just the ferrite rod, kind of like an AM radio, only much smaller and a lot more turns around it. But that's a TRF receiver in those clocks with a tuning fork crystal as a series resonator that provides the selectivity for the receiver. And the bandwidth of that crystal filter is about 10 hertz, maybe 9 hertz, something like that. The modulation is amplitude shift keyed modulation. The carrier is normally 50 kilowatt radiated power, and it drops 17 dB from that at the start of every second. And the length of time that it's dropped down to that level will give you either one of three states. It's either a marker bit, a binary one, or a binary zero. And if you, like Eric was saying, if you go to NBS's website or you go to the special publications that they publish, and they explain the format of that code, you can figure out what year it is, what day of the year it is, what the hour is, and what the second is, and what the UT1 correction currently is. Is this a leap year? Do I have a leap second coming up? All those sorts of things. And your clock has enough intelligence in it to decode that at 2 o'clock in the morning when the signal is generally stronger and there's less man-made interference, there's less lower levels of thunderstorms, interference, things like that. The watch can set itself at that time. My particular frequency standard, I have a PIC microcontroller that does a very similar thing. It looks at the time code, and it figures out what time it is, and it displays this on an LCD display, and also uses that in some of the phase signature compensation circuitry that's in the receiver, because WWVB advances the phase of their carrier 45 degrees at 10 minutes after the hour, and they go back to normal phase at 15 minutes after the hour. So I have a circuit in there that automatically switches in some phase shifting circuitry in there that compensates for that, so that the phase lock loop never goes out of lock as a result of that phase shift. K2RIW and the TechNet from KD2BD.
I can certainly see how if you didn't anticipate that 45-degree phase shift, you would be introducing an error signal into your phase lock loop integrator system, which is trying to discipline your local 10-megacycle oscillator. Fascinating. The dip in signal strength that you experience on the WWVB 60 kilohertz signal at sunrise and sunset. How many dB of dip is that, John? Is there a simple explanation for that dip? If you listen to both horizontal polarization and vertical polarization, would the dip drop? What's the mechanism of that dip? Is it polarization sensitive? I'm asking for your speculation on this one, John. KD2BD, K2RIW.
K2RIW and the TechNet from KD2BD. My speculation is that it's a result of multipath. Whether it's ground waves interfering with skywave or just several different skywave paths that are interfering with one another. I think one of the, if you go back a couple of decades in some of the NBS special publications, they show contours of WWVB signal strength around the United States. One of the things they did show you that there was almost always some kind of a dip in the signal strength around Indiana, that part of the United States, and that was like a constant effect. I've also read that it changes. It changes with season, it changes with time of day and things like that. There are sometimes when the signal is kind of weak, and by that I mean it's bordering on my my noise level. But that doesn't happen very often, and when it doesn't happen for a very long time, period of time. I haven't measured the total delta in signal strength is from peak to valley. But I can tell you one experiment that I ran. There were some times usually in the month of November, where the signal gets very strong in the evening. And I kind of made a note of that signal strength. And there was one time during the day failure, and I hooked up my receiver on battery power, and I got pretty much the same signal-to-noise ratio as I did during that evening in November when the signal was very strong. So a lot of it also has to do with local noise sources. K2RIW and the TechNet from KD2BD.
What's the size of the loop that you're using for 60 kilohertz? How many turns? Did you help self-wind it? I think you did. And what do you believe is your average signal-to-noise ratio? Is that signal 25 dB above your noise on the average day? Yeah, John, go ahead.
Yeah, it's quite good. The antenna that I'm using is overkill. It is a 40-turn loop made with 40-conductor ribbon cable. And I forgot how long the length of the cable is. But it's about maybe 4 or 5 feet in diameter. And what I did is I took 40-conductor cable, and at the bottom where the loop's hanging, I offset the connections on the loop on that 40-conductor cable. And in so doing, it's acting like a continuous coil. And I did some calculations. There's about, I think, over 600 feet of wire in that antenna. Really overkill. But I just wanted to see, you know, what an antenna like this could do. And I think I'm getting several millivolts of signal out of that loop itself. So that isn't so bad. K2RAW from KD2BD.
Now, I think you told us it's a 40-turn loop, and I think you said it was a 40-conductor ribbon cable. Are you using the 40-conductor ribbon cable as sort of lit wire, or do you have the conductors wired in such a way that the 40 turns becomes 40 times 40 turns, if you know what I mean? Over to you, John.
Yeah, I think number two is the correct answer. The connections are offset by, in other words, if you took a 40 conductor cable and you took both ends of it, you put them right, and you took the ends of that cable and put them right up against one another, you could put all those turns in parallel with one another. You would have one turn loop with 40 turns in parallel with one another. What I've done is I've done almost that, but I've offset that connection by one turn. And in so doing, I've created a 40-turn coil just using one loop of 40 conductor wire. And I do something very similar for my loop antenna on 80 meters, where it's a two-turn loop, and I use a length of 300 ohm twin lead. So at the bottom of that loop, I have that connection offset by one, thereby forming a two-turn loop with one loop of wire. K2RIW from KD2BD.
Okay, the ribbon cable itself, does the ribbon cable, before you get any offset, really make 40 turns around a form that's roughly 5 feet in diameter? Or is it making one turn and with the offset it becomes 40 turns? That's question number one. Is there really 40 turns total, or is the 40 squared turns total, which would be a lot of turns? And how many picofarads did it take to resonate the coil at 60 kilohertz? Over to you.
K2RW from KD2BD. I think the inductance of the coil was around 6 millihenries. So I think there's about, 1,500 to 2,000 picofarads of capacitance, something like that, with a trimmer across it to vary it. It's, physically, it looks like one loop of wire. But since it's 40 conductor wire, and the connections are offset by one at the bottom, electrically it's a 40-turn coil. And it's not 40 squared. There's actually 40 turns. If you were to build this just with straight piece of wire, it would take almost 700 feet. A single conductor wire, and you'd have to revolve it 40 times. K2RW from KD2BD.
Let's see, pi times 5. I guess your ribbon cable is around 18 feet long or so. Is that true?
I think so. I can check my notes. I had everything documented. It also had documented what the effective height of the antenna was, based on the Q of the antenna and things like that.
How did you choose 40 turns? You just thought that that would be enough and you could resonate it at 60 kilohertz and all would be well. And as you add more and more turns, it's going to take less and less picofarads to resonate it, and eventually you're going to be going too low in frequency just with the straight capacitance. A buddy of mine did build a HF receiving antenna to listen to that I think it was a 150 kilohertz or whatever it was, a transmission from Scandinavia that took place last year. And I believe he had too many turns, and I think he was below the resonant frequency even before he added the shunting capacitor. So it is my belief that if you had half the number of turns and a big enough capacitor so that you still resonated, although you'd get a little lower voltage out of it, the power you receive, the signal-to-noise ratio of the antenna itself, would be almost the same. Obviously, the more turns you can put, the higher the voltage you get at resonance, and therefore it becomes a little bit easier into your first stage of a, I'm guessing, field effect transistor preamplifier in order to get a good signal-to-noise ratio. Over to you for some comments on that, John. KD2BD, K2RIW.
Yeah, K2KY with a comment.
Okay, yeah. John first, then back to Mel. Go ahead, John.
Okay, K2RIW from KD2BD. I just drag out some notes here. The inductance of the coil was 6.42 millihenries, and the reason why I chose 40 turns was because I happen to have a length of 40 conductor cable, and I said, hey, you know, I could just put this together and create a resonant circuit with this. I have written down here 1 meter area, circumference 197 inches, diameter 63 inches, requires 900 picofarads of capacitance. The DC coil resistance was 40 ohms, the measured bandwidth was 1240 hertz, and my measured Q was 50. And then I did a calculation here as far as the effective height of the antenna, and it came out to be 2.5 meters. And I had, you know, there were times when I worked these equations in reverse to try to figure out what my field strength was based on the voltage that I was measuring from the loop. And so doing, you kind of creating a field strength meter when you do that. K2RIW from KD2BD.
Roughly how many microvolts per meter did you see in field strength, John?
I was seeing about 300, 350, something like that, microvolts per meter.
By my standards, that's a pretty potent signal. Roughly how many microvolts per meter is the background noise on that band?
Well, depends on the bandwidth. My first reception was using an oscilloscope, a loop antenna, a preamp, and an oscilloscope, and the signal, the carrier, was buried in the noise. Almost, it was very difficult to even distinguish it. But once you get down to a couple of hertz of bandwidth, which is really all you need to decode the modulation of the signal, or a fraction of bandwidth, which is to do your phase lock looping and your frequency reference stuff, you can have a very noisy signal, and you're still going to have enough signal-to-noise ratio for it not to be a problem. One of the last parts of the circuitry that I'm working on now has to deal with how to deal with lightning static, because a quick burst of a flash of lightning somewhere creates a very, very potent burst of energy. And what I've had to do is I've had to build some circuitry that actually detects those types of bursts of noise, and when it does detect that, I have to disable the AGC circuit in the receiver so that it doesn't become desensed as a result of that. My understanding is that a lot of the digital watch, no, actually, the analog watches that are atomically controlled, the analog watches that have WWVB receivers in them, and they have a stepper motor which steps the sweep second hand on them, they have a circuit in there that also disables the AGC when the stepper motor steps that hand every second, so as not to get desensed by the interference created by the watch itself. K2RW from KD2BD.
What did you do to make the receiver more narrow band? The antenna itself, I guess, is a little bit too broad. Did you add a back-end filter that narrows the bandwidth, John?
Yeah, I thought of using 60 kilohertz tuning fork type crystals as a filter. But then I thought, if I do this, crystals themselves are sensitive to temperature. And although using a crystal as a filter will not create a change in frequency with temperature, it will create a change in phase with temperature, which is something I wanted to try to avoid. So what I did is I heterodyne the RF signal down twice. The first heterodyne brings it down to 10 kilohertz, where I get most of my gain in a fairly narrow band op-amp type of active filter. And then the second conversion gets it down to DC or baseband, where I do most of my, where I gain most of my selectivity. So most of the selectivity is being done at baseband, and it's done with op amps, low pass filters, things like that. K2RW in the TechNet from KD2BD.
Yeah, I think that last stage has either a 1 kilohertz offset, or is it a zero IF system, a so-called homodyne receiver? Back to you, John.
Yeah, the WWVB receiver takes it down to DC. It's the receiver that I use to copy the HF signals and measure their carrier frequencies that has a 1 kHz offset. That's an image-rejecting direct conversion receiver. And that's a pretty simple receiver to build, other than the fact that you need two mixers in the front end, and you need a 90-degree phase shift in the audio line for one of those mixers, after one of those mixers. And since this is a narrow-band receiver that I'm using on HF with about 100 hertz of bandwidth, the 90-degree phase shift circuitry is really simple. It's just an all-pass filter with one op-amp, one resistor, and one capacitor, and that gives me a nice, accurate 90-degree phase shift without any change in amplitude, and that's summed with the output from the other mixer in two different ways, so I could have either lower sideband reception or upper sideband reception, and I take that into consideration when I make my calculations. So then, in that case, the local oscillator is either 1 kilohertz above or 1 kilohertz below the frequency I'm trying to receive. And in actuality, the mixing in that receiver is done with switches, JFET-type switches. And so the phase shift network that's done in that receiver is done with flip-flops. So the local oscillator that I inject into that receiver is actually four times higher than the incoming signal. And it's that four times higher frequency is what I'm actually measuring on my frequency counter when I make these measurements. K2RW in the TechNet from KD2BD.
And one last question. Your 60 kilohertz receiver, what is the final noise equivalent bandwidth? And I think it's an active op-amp low-pass filter after your zero IF, and what is your actual bandwidth there? Is it something like 1 hertz? John, go ahead.
I think it's a couple of hertz. I don't know if it's about 7 hertz or something like that. And that is what I picked for bandwidth there was just enough bandwidth to pass the BCD time code modulation that's sent by WWZ. What I did was I simulated that pulsed waveform in a SPICE program, and I connected that up to some low-pass filters, and I played around with the bandwidth of those filters until I got out what looked like a fairly reasonable filtered waveform without any overshoot and undershoot, things like that. And incidentally, that type of modulation, that code that they're transmitting on 60 kilohertz that provides the time of day and things like that, that's similar but not exactly the same as the 100 hertz subcarrier that's used on WWV and WWVH. If you have an HF receiver with some good low-frequency response, you hear that playing in the background. Sounds like some kind of a bass note that's modulated up and down. That's a similar sort of thing, and that also denotes the time of day and UTC offsets and things like that. K2RW in the TechNet from KD2BD.
And one last question before I send it over to Mel. Your final filter, let's assume that it's 7 hertz wide. Is that 7 hertz filter a multi-pole Chebyshev or Butterworth, or is it one single Gaussian pole, 7 hertz wide? Over to you, John.
I have to find it. I think it's a single op amp with, I think, 2 capacitors, 2 resistors. So I think it's a 2-pole filter, and it's a Bessel filter. I remember I wanted to make sure that I didn't get any overshoot and ringing and things of that sort. So it has a Bessel characteristic. And I'm looking, not looking at it right now. Whatever bandwidth this filter has, the receiver has twice that bandwidth at the RF frequency. Yeah, it's a 5 hertz Bessel filter. There are 2 capacitors, 2 resistors, and so my RF bandwidth, my RF detection bandwidth, then is twice that. It's 10 hertz. K2RW from KD2BD.
And if you made it any more narrow, and if it wasn't a Bessel function, you would be distorting the modulation you're looking for. Fascinating. And all this can be done without amps. In the old days, they had to use great big inductors and capacitors and so on. With an operational amplifier, by Miller effect and whatever, you can synthesize great big capacitors and great big inductors. In the case of simulating an inductor with an op amp, you're using something called a negative impedance converter. But we won't go there tonight. This is the technical net. We don't get that deep. Mel, K2KEY, K2RIW, go ahead.
Hey, this is K2KEY. You know, when John starts thinking about the loop, receiving loop, as you remember, I did a lot of experimenting. I have an 80-meter receiving loop. And I found, of course, you know, when I was battling a lot of this static, which will be coming up again pretty soon, we start getting into the summer months in the United States, especially the South, becomes the center of the lightning of the world, really. Most lightning strikes, I guess, ever been recorded was down in Florida. So we get to that point, as I used last year with some success, is this receiving loop with the two loops, one loop inside the other, if you remember, Dick. And what I do is put it into a QRN squasher. And that is the only way I've been able to really go through the summer months and operate on 75 meters or 80 meters. So I based that loop was based on a little different principle. The circumference of 80 meters around it is approximately, let's see, it's 3, 6, 9, 12 feet, 3 feet on a side. And the receiving loop is half that size. And yes, when I guess we remember talking about it, that... you remember what I could achieve with it was a really enormous success. So I was wondering, is that feasible for, well, I've seen it for 160, and we see this magazine for 160, the antenna book, but I was wondering, do you think you can go lower in frequency with that method, Dick, over?
I think the answer is yes. Now, loop antennas and the effective capture area of a loop antenna is very similar to what happens with a dipole antenna and its effective capture area. A full 80-meter dipole, 132 feet long, made out of 14-gauge household wire, for instance, and that's not a big variable, what I'm about to say, at resonance in free space, that antenna does have a gain of 2.14 dB over dipole, over isotropic. Every dipole has, every high-efficiency dipole made out of good materials, in other words, has 2.14 decibels of gain over isotropic due to its antenna pattern. When you work out the formulas for the area of every antenna, area is gain lambda squared over 4 pi, where that's effective area, gain lambda squared over 4 pi. That formula and the rearrangement of the formula, gain equals 4 pi a over lambda squared. This is the exact same formula, it's just rearranging where the variables are located. That formula is at the bedrock of the antenna measuring science. Although we don't often think about it, every antenna we've ever built only receives some signal because it has the equivalent of a certain amount of area over which it collects that signal. Just to go back to give you a little bit of a feeling for what's going on, assume I've got a 100-watt light bulb in the middle of a spherical room. Assume the light bulb is an isotropic radiator. Assume it's radiating 100 watts of light. I'm using some drastic simplifications here. And if the spherical room had an inside area of that sphere of 100 square meters, 100 watts was radiated by the bulb isotropically, 100 square meters of room area, each square meter would be getting 1 watt of energy. So if my antenna had an effective area in that room of 1 square meter, it would receive 1 watt of the energy that's being transmitted by that light bulb. Let me drop. The bottom line of all this is that every antenna we've ever used has an effective area. Whether you calculate it or not is up to you. But if you think in an area relationship, it gives you a lot of understanding of what's going on. If I take that 80-meter dipole, which is 132 feet long, and I squeeze it down, I just cut off some wire, so now it's only 32 feet long instead of 132 feet long. I've cut off 100 feet of the wire. And now the antenna is resonated at somewhere like 10 meters or 20 meters instead of 80 meters. However, if I use a good antenna tuner and a low feed line, or if I zigzag the wire and the total end-to-end distance physically maybe is 32 feet, but is close to 132 feet of wire there, or I put loading coils in the center of the antenna, and or I put top hat capacitors at the tip of the antenna, by various techniques, I can make the physical end-to-end dimension of the antenna 32 feet instead of 132 feet, but I can bring it back into resonance by the loading coils, the top hat capacitors, the zigzag, the antenna tuner, or any combination of there above. When I bring it back into resonance at 80 meters, even now it's one-third of the original length. As long as I use lossless materials, believe it or not, I will get 90-some-odd% of the effective capture area back. That's a hard one to accept. I'll accept that. Once again, the full half-wave dipole, 132 feet long, had an effective capture area of 8,500 square feet. If you stand back a mile away and look at that antenna with your telescope, assuming your eyes operated at 80 meters, you would see a great big elliptical black hole in space with the dipole antenna going down the center of that ellipse, and the total ellipse would have 8,500 square feet of area. Any horizontally polarized signal at 80 meters arriving in the vicinity of that antenna, 8,500 square feet of it would be gathered by that resonating 80-meter dipole and repeater.
Time out.
8,500 square feet of it would be gathered by that antenna, It would be fed down the feed line, go into the receiver, eventually come out the loudspeaker, and eventually move the S-meter. When you squeeze it down to 32 feet instead of 132 feet, but re-resonate it, again you will get back the same almost 8,500 square feet of area. Maybe it's 8,300 square feet. You're going to get back 90-some-odd% of the area. That's the magic of resonance. Resonance does that. Creates a great big, let's call it a magnetic field, but it's more complicated than that. Magnetic field around the antenna. It still gathers the same amount of signal. Once you accept that for a dipole, I don't blame you for being skeptical of what I said. What I just said doesn't make good common sense. But you read the appropriate chapter of one of the Bible antenna books. For instance, Krauss's book, W-H-A-K, on antennas. That's the name of the McGraw-Hill book, 1950, Antennas. You read his chapter on the infinitesimal dipole. And if you understand what he says, he is saying pretty much what I just said. An infinitesimal dipole at resonance, made of lossless material, has 90-some-odd%. You lose no more than half a decibel of the gain or effective capture area. Craziness, but that's true. Now, where do you build your antenna? In a dipole manner or a miniaturized dipole manner? Whether you build your antenna as a loop or a miniaturized loop antenna? In any of those cases, as long as you re-resonated it with lossless material, you will get that effective capture area. It may become more difficult to losslessly resonate a very small loop with very few turns, and the voltage you get out of it, you might not be happy enough compared to the noise voltage of your particular field effect first preamplifier stage of your receiver. Coming up. So there's a strong motivation in some cases to use more turns of the loop. But as far as the signal the loop itself picks up in signal-to-noise ratio, for the most part, it is not dependent on the number of turns of the loop. Yes, if you use more turns. It's like having a secondary winding of a transformer with more turns, and you get more voltage out of it, assuming you can resonate it. But the signal-to-noise ratio itself, let's call it the power that the antenna picks up, that essentially doesn't change. Its effective capture area does not change with the number of turns. Ain't that crazy? I wonder if you've ever heard anything like this before, Mel, because you've been a guy experimenting with loop antennas now for, what, at least 5 or 6 years that I know about. K2KEY and the group, K2RIW and the TechNet. I'll give a nice long drop in case somebody wants to join us.
Take the note down so you're by yourself.
Okay, we're all alone, Mel. It's just you and me, kid. You got it, Mel.
Okay, that's why I did a letter drop it book and somebody wants to join us. Ken wants to say something. He joins us. Well, that's when we got into this discussion many years ago, you know, and I told you about, I said I had my doubts that time with the loop antenna, you know, they featured that loop antenna in the antenna handbook. If you remember that one picture standing there with the gentleman who designed it, his wife standing there next to it, and he was basically telling how well it works on 160 meters. So I said, gee, let's see what happens on 80 meters with it. And I built one on 80 meters, and I guess you know what the story is. We did discuss it in detail how well it works as a receiving loop. And then I got the second idea, of course, to add another one and go through a process that I actually could focus one on the noise peak. It's very, like I say, it moved this thing around. It is quite sharp. The tuning of it, of course, extremely sharp. But I found if I moved it around the one loop, I could get the noise level, peak the noise level, and then using that QRN squasher technique, I'm able to take the noise level. Let me let it drop. I'm able to take the noise level in many cases, which would be horrendous, literally, you know, 5'9" plus on 80 meters during the summertime, and take it down to a comfortable level where I am able to get a good copy on a signal that many signals coming through are 5'9", but that's not sufficient many times, of course, during the summertime with all that noise. So there's no doubt that they're loop antennas, and they have been, of course, trying to sell them for years with not much success, because I know somebody was in the business of making them for transmitting, not only receiving, but transmitting HF loops. And yet, you know, it's been laughed off for many years, Dick, over.
Fascinating. Let me say a couple of words about loops versus dipoles or monopoles. In the case of every one of the handy talkies that we all own on either 2 meters or 450, for instance, the rubber duck antenna on the top of that handy talkie really is a quarter wave ground plane antenna, a monopole. The ground plane radials are not really there. It happens to be the metal case of the radio inside of that plastic box that you hold on to, the capacitive coupling to your hand, your arm, and the rest of your body is the counterpoise for that antenna. You probably have noticed on a number of occasions when you're listening to a very weak signal on your 2-meter handy-talkie, and you position it in left and right and up and down and twist it and whatever until you get the best signal. And maybe the best signal is when the radio is purely vertical, and you set it on the wooden table in front of you, and your hand is still on the radio, and you're hearing the signal very nicely. You pull your hand away from the radio, and the signal goes into the noise. You've removed some of the counterpoise for the poor handy-talkie radio. Part of that antenna was you. And also there's some reflection of your body, and some of that reflection is changing when you back away. But it's fascinating to take a weak signal on a repeater received in your house and position the radio in various ways. As you guys have heard me say on many occasions, whenever I'm listening to this particular repeater while I'm shaving in the morning, I have to put the handy-talkie on the wooden bench in front of me, on the wooden table in my bathroom. I set the radio horizontal, even though this is a purely vertical signal. By the time that signal gets into my particular backyard in Huntington, it's a horizontal signal from the strongest. And when I set the radio vertical, I don't hear as much. And sometimes it fades into the noise. So, that's the reception from a loop antenna. And if you're using an FM radio, 88 to 188 megacycle FM broadcast, many of these handheld radios also have a whip antenna coming out of the top, and some of them do not, but many of them do. When you go all the way down to one megacycle of reception for AM broadcast radios, let me drop. Years and years ago, many automobiles had a whip antenna that listened to AM broadcast. Because the AM broadcast signal is a 1,000-foot wavelength, let me think now, 3.5 times, yeah, it's close to a 1,000-foot wavelength. That whip antenna wants to be 250-foot tall. Obviously, your automobile would not allow you to put a whip on it 250 feet tall. So the whip is really a couple of feet tall, and the rest of it is a loading coil at the bottom of the antenna, maybe on the far end of the transmission line, inside of the radio, but there is the equivalent of a loading coil there in order to resonate that whip. And back in the days when you had an AM whip antenna on your car, you probably recognized the fact that it was a peculiar resonance antenna. That is to say, there was a tracking coil inside where you tracked the RF amplifier with that loading coil to make sure that the antenna would track as you go from the low end of the band at roughly 500 kc to the high end of the band at roughly 1.5 megacycles. And it was an extremely high impedance antenna. Put your hand on that antenna anywhere along its length, touch it very lightly, and the signal coming out of the loudspeaker, unless you were right alongside of the broadcast station, the signal would disappear. It's a very high impedance antenna. Snow on the antenna would stop its reception. Snow on the base of the antenna would short it out. Well, in the case of a handheld radio for AM reception, you can decide to do it with a loop antenna, a whip antenna, with a great big loading coil, where you're listening to the E field, and let me backtrack on this one. That 1.5 or 1.0 or 0.5 megacycle AM broadcast signal that gets into your backyard has an E field component and an H field component. It's a transverse electromagnetic field. If you could see that wave coming towards you, it is a planar wave where the E field is vertically polarized and the magnetic field is horizontally polarized. And it's a flat sheet of this stuff coming toward you, and you could decide to listen to the H field with a loop antenna or listen to the E field with a whip antenna. The choice is yours. But when it comes to compact radios at low frequencies, there's a significant advantage of listening with a loop antenna and listening to the H field. It's a much more compact antenna, which is much less sensitive. You put your hand near that loop antenna, and it almost doesn't stop its reception. And that loop antenna is also directional, just like the whip was. You take a ferrite loop stick type AM radio, and if you aim it in various directions, you'll notice that you can get good reception and a no in reception, and you can direction find with that. There are people out to sea in their rowboat who had an AM radio, and knowing where the AM broadcast stations are located, and worked and orienting the AM loop stick radio in the right way to null out those signals, they could easily figure out with a little bit of a map where they were in, say, for instance, the Long Island Sound in a fog. And they could find out which way to go, even though they might not have a compass. You can direction find with a radio by knowing its antenna pattern. And picking up the H field with that loop antenna, in the case of the loop antenna on your AM radio, you're listening to a signal that's close to 1,000 feet long in wavelength, and that little loop stick antenna is a couple of inches long, and maybe it's a few eighths of an inch in diameter, with wire wrapped around that ferrite rod, and it does a beautiful reception. It's got great effective capture area, even though it's physically small, because it is resonated. Study the schematic diagram. Let me drop. Study the schematic diagram of that radio, and you realize the 365 picofarad dual variable capacitor in the front end that does the tuning. One portion of the capacitor is making the local oscillator go up and down as you tune across the dial. The other section of the capacitor is adding in capacitance and subtracting capacitance from the loop stick to keep it resonant, and it tracks. The local oscillator and the RF amplifier or the loop stick antenna resonate have to track each other. You have to resonate that loop stick antenna in order to get that effective capture area, even though it's physically small in size. And if you calculated the square feet of effective capture area of that loop antenna, I don't know what the number is, but it's a large number of square feet. It's a very interesting antenna. So what your eye sees on simple antennas that are resonant and what the radio signal sees are very, very different. If that 80-meter dipole of mine, sitting 30 feet in the air, I'm going to make it 60 feet in the air, happens to be north-south in wire orientation, and I want to listen to a guy that's east or west of me, broadside to that wire, beautiful. And if there is a loco or a Con Ed wire across the street, horizontally polarized, at the exact same altitude as my dipole, common sense would lead you to believe you're going to get a great big blockage in that area. Absolutely not. You don't get that blockage because that loco or Con Ed wire is not resonant. It's an eighth-inch diameter piece of wire, 132 feet long, is the portion of it that you care about, of that loco wire. It's casting a shadow onto your antenna of 1 square foot. But your antenna has a radio area of 8,500 square feet. You may not like the arcing over noise and the QRNANCY that wiring gives you, but as far as a shadowing device, it is transparent because it is not resonant. Ain't that crazy? That's the magic of resonance within an antenna. A standing wave structure where that signal bounces back and forth at least 20 times, that resonance phenomena allows it to have this very large capture area. The mechanism by which it does that, not even Maxwell's equations are going to really explain that to you. We're getting now back to the area where...
Repeater, time out.
We're getting back into the area where Mel, Dick, Alex, and other guys, and Glenn, who would like to know what a radio wave really looks like. Knowing that from the transmitting antenna, not one single electron goes into space. An electromagnetic field goes into space. That's what you're transmitting. It consists of photons, if you want to be a scientist. And you can calculate the amount of energy in each one of those photons. And what does a photon look like? I haven't the vaguest idea. I know that the wave itself acts like it's a planar sheet of material when it's transmitted for a long distance, and it comes into your backyard, and it hits your antenna, and your antenna has some amount of affected area. And once you start thinking of antennas in an area relationship, it'll give you an intuitive understanding of how antennas work, which you can take to the bank. I do. It is my understanding, or what I think is an understanding, of an area relationship that allows me to run my antenna consulting business. People pay me for doing that kind of, and for developing those kind of antennas that use that knowledge. They're willing to pay for that rare little bit of understanding. And sometimes it works. And I'm telling you that if you also learn to think of antennas in an area relationship, it'll give you a little bit closer understanding toward Mother Nature's truth as to what in the world is really going on here. We only partially understand it. The schools don't teach it very well. The ham radio operators, they've got more of a secret than any other group of people, in my opinion. Because we talk to each other about what works and what doesn't work, and with real hands-on empirical experience, we are teaching each other what works. That's what's going on with this technique. It's a meeting of the clan in which we're teaching each other how wireless techniques work. Where is the magic? We don't have the whole answer, but we think we've got a little bit more of the answer. Maybe you guys have got some questions about all this jazz. K2RIW and the TechNet. Mel and Dick are listening.
WS2N, question on this topic.
Call recognized. Anyone else? You know, that great big long soapbox controversial thing I just said. Only Paul's got a question. Go ahead, Paul. WS2N, you got it.
Okay, Dick, in trying to understand the area of your previous statement with the 80-meter dipole shrinking it down. Let me reverse that. Instead of the receiving end of it, the transmitting end of it, I think would help me understand that better. I'll make a statement, and you let me know if I'm on the right track, because the receiving end, you know, with the sphere around the antenna, it's a little hard for me to, you know, to imagine, like you said, the shrinking of the antenna. You know, you would think was something's going to change. But am I right to assume that thinking of it in a transmitting fashion, where you, let's say you're putting out that 100 watt, and now each square meter in that sphere that you were talking about is, you know, originally you said was receiving 1 watt of power per square meter. Well, when you shrink the antenna down in the transmit mode, and you shrunk it down, and you re-resonated it, and you're transmitting it, as long as that 100 watts is still going out, your SWR is good on your radio, and you still got the same output going out on that antenna. Wouldn't that, my question really is, wouldn't that same 1 watt hitting that 1 square meter the same as before, but with the 80 meter, you know, full 80 meter dipole? Wouldn't that be the case? Of course, you say 90%. I still don't know where the other 10% went, but if that's the way, if that's true, then to me, I understand it better in the transmit mode than the receive mode. Back to you, Dick. WS2N.
I'm very glad you asked the question, Paul, because I realized I created a little bit of a problem by mixing two things together. When I talked about the 100-watt light bulb in the middle of a spherical room, I was trying to use that as an example of a nearly isotropic antenna, nearly isotropic transmitting system. Isotropic means it sends equal amount of signal in all directions. So that 100-watt light bulb, if it's an ideal one, radiating 100 watts of light, we'll say, in a spherical room where the inside area of the room is 100 square meters, in my example, in theory, each square meter is going to get 1 watt of light. And whether I'm transmitting or receiving, it's going to work the same way. In other words, if I lit up the room, if I made the room out of electroluminescent panels, where each panel was 1 square meter, in each panel was radiating 1 watt of power. And I've got 100 of those panels in this spherical room. And they radiate a signal back to that light bulb.